You know what this is like? It's like those old movies we both love.
Now I'm gonna tell you my whole plan, and then I'm gonna come up with some absurd and convoluted way to kill you, and you'll find an equally convoluted way to escape.
Sounds good to me.
Well, this ain't that kind of movie.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another movie podcast. The show that creates top tens for your enjoyment, but really for our ego. I am Oscar, and with me today is...
Your ego, and Ralph.
You're part of the show, Ralph. It's our ego. I go by ego.
Dad joke.
Totes.
No, I just do it because you tell me to.
That's your ego. Anything because I told them to.
All our top ten.
So that's, maybe.
All our lists.
Yeah, am I that convincing?
Not really.
You guys are just like, whatever.
I mean, if I want to be on the show, I got to do it, so.
I guess so. You want to be on the show that much, huh?
Meh. Well,
something's got to give in this conversation.
Eventually.
Huh? Anyway, you can send feedback to podmoviecast@gmail.com and also check out our website, otherpodcast.com, for all future stuff and all information you're going to need ever on the show, including how to donate to this wonderfully new boutique podcast.
Yeah, you guys should check out the website. It shows nice, cool images of each like movie that we highlight for the review for each podcast.
You like the images I pick?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I very meticulously cool. Picked them. I try anyway, especially for our top 10 shows this whole month. So yeah, this is the last show, guys. This is the last top 10 of the month. Are you done with them? Are you glad that we're done with them?
Not of the year, because we'll get to one in December for sure, and probably somewhere in between.
What do you mean we'll get to another top 10?
Yeah.
What do you mean? Well, I mean, I know we'll do the halfway point, right? The movies of the year so far.
Yeah.
But for a long time, it'll be fun.
For a couple months.
Just for that, I'm going to introduce top tens every other show. Just for that.
Go ahead. Okay.
All right, fine. This is our top 10 discoveries. This is the full title of it. Top 10 full discoveries made in 2016. And we'll discuss what that means in a second. I just want to really quick say that for all of you who decide to, wonderfully so, donate to our show that we just are starting for you guys. Bonus episode goes out for those people. So this month will be Martin Scorsese's latest film, Silence. This is literally the last chance we have on air anyway, Ralph, to tell people about it before if they want to get that bonus episode in time. Actually, it's funny we're recording this tonight. So it's going to be a fun episode. I know we're going to have a lot to talk about. So
yeah, we're recording the review in silence.
Yeah, in silence too.
Right, exactly.
30 minutes of that.
Right. Uh-huh.
Anyway, so if you're interested, check that out. It's also on the website, like I mentioned, otherpodcast.com. All this shit's on every show notes for every show we put out. Now, let's get into our top 10. We don't have any what we've been watching. We're just going to skip right through it.
But I should really look at my number 10.
Probably. But no, we're going to explain first what the hell we're talking about, Ralph. What is...
So you're going to explain it. I'm going to add on to it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is an interesting one. I like to think that, you know, there are plenty of podcasts out there that deal with media arts and TV, film, or even musicals or plays or something like that. They all have, at the end of the year, they have top 10 lists or top 5 lists or the best of something, a show that translates, that compiles the whole year and how he feels, essentially, usually in a numbered ranking system. We did that already. This is our fourth one now. So we did TV, we did games, we did movies. Now we're doing discoveries. I figured to do a good show, to be good and to be challenging for us and give the audience something to think about beyond the regular norm of top 10 shit. I introduced this thing a few years back in our old show, discoveries. So discoveries means that things in art that we've discovered individually from each other throughout the year that did not come from the year we're talking about. So it's a chance to talk about movies or books or albums or music artistry or even just pure artists, painters, that we had no idea about, but they came from different years past. That way we can introduce a little bit of history into not just the now of every show.
Right.
Because although everyone focuses on the now, but no one looks back.
Right.
It's our way to look back a bit.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You want to add to that?
Yeah. It's a harder list than you think because you come across through a lot of things that you want to add on to a list in a year, but it came out that year. So you can't. So you have to think of something that came out before that you just recently discovered.
Right.
So that's like the hard thing. So
the real trick is something that's new to you but did not come out that year.
Right, exactly.
So you usually like what you would see, what's common, and you'll see it on my list too, I think on one or two titles. What's common is that you'll see something like in 2016, right? We're doing discoveries in 2016. You'll see some stuff that came out in 2015 that I didn't have a chance to catch up that year. So like if they really did like stick in my mind and I found them really awesome and I couldn't make it for my top 10 of the 15, you know, then it might make up an appearance on the discoveries list next year, you know. Like that's not super uncommon either, so that's good.
Right.
Yeah, I have one like that. I think my number 9 is that. Anyway, any other caveats to mention?
No, I'll tell you what.
Was it hard for you to keep track of stuff?
No, this year or last year, I did, at least my movies were easier because I kept a spreadsheet.
Yeah, I keep a notes app and I just write everything new I read or whatever.
Yeah.
Sometimes I forget though. Like there's one I forgot until today. Like, oh yeah, I wouldn't have made my top 10 anyway.
Sure.
But I forgot about it. Like, oh yeah.
Yeah, well, the thing about a spreadsheet and a notepad is that if you don't add it around there right away, you tend to forget about things.
Right, unless they really stick up and whatever. Exactly. Yeah, really weird things.
Yeah, I just tend to do a quick glance around my house, see what I still have.
That's funny.
That's so like, you know, skim through the old comic books and stuff like that. So, yeah, I can't think of anything. I will tell you when I cheat, but sure.
Cool. Well, in that case, now speaking of cheating, we're going to go with you and see what you've done. See what you've done here. So we haven't, this is the one show where we haven't shown each other the lists.
Right.
So because it's Discovery, so if you figure that the chances of overlap is pretty high, I mean, pretty low.
Pretty
sorry.
Low, yeah.
So, and we're going to surprise each other, not a big deal. And there's no, it's just those two. You know, Luke isn't a part of this one this time. So, Ralph, without further ado, what is your number 10?
My number 10 is a book that my brother gifted to me, and it's called The Girl with All the Gifts.
I really hate you.
Is that your number 10?
It's my number 10.
Perfect. Let's talk about it.
Did you fucking copy me? This is the. I just said that the overlap is a... Yeah, it's your number 10, all right.
So...
What the fuck?
Yeah, overlap is high, and then... Really high, apparently.
Well, it should be the only one.
Right, I think it is, actually.
Maybe not.
Maybe another one.
Yeah, maybe
we'll see. That being said, The Girl with All the Gifts. It almost didn't make my list.
Me too.
But it made it up there because I actually really did like it. I thought it was an original enough story. And I actually liked the way it was written. Narrated specifically, also. So it worked out for me. It managed to depict the picture, and I got to kind of be in this world, and that's really cool about a book. If a book can put you in their world and you can actually see everything they're talking about, that's really cool. That's really good about a book. And I know you could do that. You do that with every book because you have to think of something. Like your imagination goes wild. But I saw something. I saw a lot of very clear stuff, and it could be just because of the fact that the subject matter is zombies or zombie like creatures that. We have so much of it that I can just kind of piece together things that I've liked from...
The Hungries.
Right, The Hungries, yeah. Piece together from other compilations of things, and we can just... And I make my narrative from the story, from those, like, clips of everything else that I can put together mm-hmm. in my head, and it works really well. I like the story, though. I thought it was a really cool story, and I love the ending, and I think that's what kind of got it on my top 10 for the ending.
Right.
So yeah, what did you think of this book?
First of all, you're welcome for gifting it.
Sure.
No, I'm kidding. This is written by M.R. Carey, and it came out in 2014, I just want to say, so it does fit our criteria. And it is completely dystopian. It's more dystopian than it is horror. It's not a horror book. I'm going to put that out there. It is not Resident Evil. It is definitely a genre, subgenre type of thing, where, yes, the mythology of zombies is shown in a more scientific and slightly different lens. And not just scientific, but like natural, and that's not a spoiler. But if you read the book, you know what I mean by when I say natural. It feels very natural, especially with the ending. And yeah, it's very interesting. I love the clash of humanity trying to keep the old way alive,
right?
And while not realizing that the world is telling them, "Hey, move the fuck on,
move
now.
The fuck on, yeah,"
and really by force,
which is actually,
and it's personified by the little girl who is the star of the film,
right?
The
exactly, book. Which is actually kind of like what the world does anyway for us,
right?
Like,
And I found that interesting, the idea of letting go and learning new new digs. I mean, not just suffering with all the people that died so far and reacclimating to new civilization. It's not that. It's just tearing that out, too, you know. And it's much more complicated than that. And the reason I sought this book out, never heard of it before, is because when the festival circuits were running in mid-2016, I heard about the movie called, the same title, The Girl with All the Gifts. And I hear it was amazing. It's a zombie movie, and it's with, like, children. I'm like, that's awesome. I want to see that. I'm a horror fan, so I'm like, fuck yes, I want to see that. Never came out that year. Never came out last year. So hopefully it'll come out this year in 2017. But I was like, in the meantime, I was just like, I can read the book. And I did, and I gifted it to you, and I was like, it was amazing. So I'm really hoping for the movie. I hope it's as good as...
I saw a trailer for it.
Oh, there's a trailer out? Yeah. I've been avoiding the trailers. I'm sure it'll come up eventually.
I hunted for one.
Oh, yeah? Is it good?
Yeah.
Is it English, by the way?
British.
Or English, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so it is... The movie's English, I mean.
The movie's English.
Oh, yeah. The actors are? Okay, cool. That's cool. Because I had no idea. It could be American, for all I know.
Yeah. It's a lot in the trailer, I'll tell you that much.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
A lot of spoilers?
Well, I mean, luckily you don't know what the fuck's going on, but...
Well, but we know.
But we know.
Yeah, we know.
Like, I was just like, oof, that's a lot.
Ouch. Like, ouch, what a spoil that fucker.
Right, yeah.
Right on. So that's the reason I sought this book out, and that's the reason I gifted it to Roth, and that's why it's our number 10, The Girl with All the Gifts. We're on to our number 9. Roth, what's your number 9?
My number 9 is a movie that came out in 1954, so I think it fits the criteria. This is a... It's an unknown director. It's Alfred Hitchcock, who...
Up and coming
in the 50s. Yeah, no, this movie is called Dial M for Murder.
Oh, is your first time seeing it?
It's my first
time
ever.
I wish it's my first
time
to see it, so I could put it on my list.
First time ever watching this movie, and I'm a guy who really loved the movie A Perfect Murder with
Michael Douglas.
With Michael Douglas, yeah. And I actually ended up watching this. No, it's not Demi Moore.
That's another one.
It's that other white girl who has short hair, because it was the 90s and everybody had short hair.
Sure.
I can't. I can't think of her name.
Stark's girlfriend, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Kate. No, I can't imagine.
Not Kate Blanchett.
That's a good actress.
Yeah. Exactly.
I don't remember.
That being said, quick thing. It's an ex-tennis pro carries out a plot to murder his wife. When things go wrong, he improvises a brilliant plan B. And motherfucker, that is a brilliant plan B.
I haven't seen it in a while.
This movie starring Ray Milland, Grace Kelly, come on, guys. Robert Cummings, and John Williams. We have... this picture that I'm going to show Oscar here, it shows exactly how what type of mischievous movie this is. And right there, you'll see it. Like that face shows everything. That expression on his face.
Yep.
And I really like this, how he plans this almost perfect murder, and he really thinks of things through, but. What he doesn't account for, and it's what everybody never accounts for, is the human factor. Humans, right? We're bound to either make mistakes or do something different. Like
what was that movie we saw? Sully was about that.
Right, exactly. Yeah. That's a big thing. Where he's like, you're not going to account for a human thing. And they give him, like, what, 50 seconds or 30 seconds or something?
Yeah, yeah.
Something stupid. Yeah, I really like this movie because you know where it's going. I'm sorry, it's been ruined, right? It's a fucking 50s movie, and it's been ruined. Like, you know, he gets caught, guys. But it's how he really tries to, like, that plan B is really cool. How he really tries to get out of it. He did. He was living the high life for a while, and it just it almost worked out. And if it wasn't for this fucking amazing detective who, like, really, or inspector, should I say? Because they're in England.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. He really pushes for this, like. To figure this out on a hunch, like the hell of a hunch, that pays out for him. He would have gotten away with murder, which would have been awesome.
Yep.
So it's a really great movie, and it shows why Hitchcock can do such great movies, or why we copy Hitchcock, his style and anything.
Yeah, they don't call him the master of suspense for nothing.
Oh my God, it's a great movie.
He really developed some techniques that resonate with every movie you watch, kind of.
Right.
Yeah, he's great. I love him. So that's Dial M for Murder.
Yes.
That's your number nine. My number nine is a film as well. It is The Diary of a Teenage Girl, which came out in 2015. Have you seen this?
No. No, please explain.
I own it. I thought you seen it by now. A teen artist living in 1970s San Francisco enters into an affair with her mother's boyfriend. So, yeah, it's kind of a little grody, as it sounds. And it stars Belle Powley as Minnie, Alexander Skarsgård from True Blood as the boyfriend. Kristen Wiig plays her mother, which is interesting because you see a Kristen Wiig who just likes to get drunk and be a bad mother. Not at all funny. Very little funny. I don't think it's funny at all, actually. this is directed by Marielle Heller. And it's based off some sort of adaptation of like some comic book or graphic novel about the drawing styles of this girl in the movie, where she's trying to be a graphic novelist and a comic book artist, and apparently the writer of the book eventually becomes that, and the style of the drawings are the same. And what I love about this movie is the complete adult attempt and successful attempt to show us a teenage girl's perspective into an adult situation. Not just the adult situation. There's a lot of other stuff that goes along, but the idea of the headspace, you know what I'm talking about? The
sure.
headspace of someone who we don't really know, because we're not teenage girls, but like we were teenagers, so we understand some of that. I think a lot of that goes into the really adult and delicate way it's handled. It handles all the sex, all of the eventual drugs, the adult themes that is really way over her head, and her decisions are clearly not rooted into anything practical or wise, you know, as you can imagine.
Right.
And if you watch the movie, I think you'll see what I mean. And the lighting alone, I think, describes a lot about what the movie's trying to invoke and feeling. So when you see her freaking out over the fact that, you know, she is sleeping with her mom's boyfriend, which is kind of strange. She's freaking out, like, about, you know, some bad high they're having, or the fact that she can't live with him, you know, because he can't obviously do that because she's a teenager and he's like 30-something or whatever. And it's just, you know, very, very interesting. And I haven't seen it since, like, way earlier in the year, last year. So I don't have any great details for you.
Yeah.
But I remember it still stuck with me, the feelings of what it brought. And I remember feeling that this movie's surprisingly well-made and emotionally kind of hard-hitting. It's good. The Diary of a Teenage Girl.
Cool.
I recommend that for everyone. Not everyone with the appropriate age. And right. Don't watch it with your mother, for fuck's sake. So that's my number nine. What is your number eight?
Ralph? My number eight is a book that came out in 2014. This book is, can't tell you right now. It is written by John Scalzi, who does books all the time, apparently. And, the book's called Lock In. I'll read a quick synopsis. I don't want to get, this is a really long synopsis, but I'll read my version of it.
Okay.
Not too long ago from today, a new, highly contagious virus makes its way across the globe. Most who get sick experience nothing worse than the flu, fever, and headaches. But for the unlucky 1% and nearly 5 million souls in the U.S., the disease causes lock-in. Victims fully awake and aware, but unable to move or respond to stimulus.
Weird.
And this affects old, young, like, doesn't matter.
It's not a prejudice virus.
It's not a prejudice virus, yeah. Right. So, yeah, this is an interesting book, where that takes place during one of the president's things, and then they kind of fast forward to the future, where now we've established, because what ends up happening is that a famous person who gets it, and the reason it becomes like a really big disease,
mm-hmm.
It's called the Hayden syndrome, because the president... the president's wife ended up getting it at the time, the president of the United States.
Okay.
So they put billions of dollars in research for this.
Right.
And now we're in the future where we have robots that those people who suffer through lock-in can use robots in the real world, like mechs kind of thing, suits basically, that get to go around and, like, you know, do life things. Because they can they found out that you can't actually tap. They're still awake. They're still in there, right?
Right.
Their minds are active, but everything else isn't. It's like being, like, what's it called?
Like paralyzed?
Yeah, it's like being paralyzed permanently forever. You can't even control your body functions, but you know things are happening. Like the rich people can afford the richer stuff, obviously, and the poor people
the
can,
doy,
right, exactly. And those guys get like they even rent apartments to go charge their bots, but their apartments are like the size of a closet, a linen closet, you know, because all you need to do is fit them in there to charge, and that's
right,
it.
That's it.
Right. So it's interesting. It's an interesting thing, and it's about a detective who, because it's obviously very political. It's about a detective or a guy who, one of the guys who suffers from lock-in, really, really famous guy, who becomes an FBI agent, and he goes through this, through this case about someone killing people of the Hayden syndrome, right, that suffer lock-in. And it gets into this weird, big sci-fi thing about, because it is sci-fi-ish, about how, very political also, where they get into this, how do I explain it? They, the company, finally, who, like, owns the space, because they have, all these people who suffer lock-in, have, like, an internet space for themselves that, so they can communicate with other people. It's like an open area space where you can, just like if you were walking in real life and people are talking around you or anything, it works exactly like that. A company takes over that, and they're going to start basically charging premiums about stuff like that because it used to be free. And someone figures out that you can actually hack into these people's bodies and stuff and use them against their will. And then they kind of stumble upon that, and then are trying to figure out who's causing this, right? And it's an interesting detective story, but it's a sci-fi detective story, and it reminded me a lot of very famous Blade Runner, where it's a detective story, right?
It's like Blade Runner meets Surrogates.
Yeah, I would say that's an interesting one to say, minus the surrogate part where they, you know, whatever. And what I forgot to mention because I'm an idiot is that there's another percentage of people who, you know, if you suffered through like the process of lock-in, like you could have made it out without getting it, the disease. You get a partial disease where you never suffered lock-in, but you become attuned to their kind of brain chemistry, and you can actually be used as a surrogate, as you brought it up.
Oh.
And then they can, because your brain chemistry fits the same way as theirs. And only people who have had the disease can actually go through it. And only that's an even smaller percentage of people than the 1% that suffer the lock-in.
Right, right.
So it's an interesting, really interesting concept that I'm doing no justice to the book, but I really enjoyed it because it was like this cool crime, not noir, but crime movie or book. I keep saying movie, crime book that takes, it's a sci-fi adventure as well, and it's I really enjoyed it, and I think. More people should read it. It's a quick novel, so they shouldn't take too long. What's I finished it in 2 days. It's called Lock-In.
Lock-In. Yeah. Lock-In or Locked-In?
Lock-In.
Got it. Yeah. Like Lockout.
Like Lockout.
Space Jail.
Within.
Everyone wants Space
Minus
Jail.
Minus Space Jail.
Okay.
I didn't see Space Jail.
I mean, I saw it. Pretty terrible, but good, yep. Bad. All right, so that's your number eight, right? My number eight is a film called Pontypool.
Cool.
Let me read the description here. A psychological thriller in which a deadly virus infects a small Ontario town. That is a very vague thing, but that's okay. It stars Stephen McHattie, Liza Hoole, and Georgina Riley. I think the rest are really bit parts. There's really no people in this movie. This is written by Tony Burgess, directed by Bruce McDonald, and it is, I don't know if it's considered to be in a foreign film, made completely in Canada or not. I think it was, but I'm not 100%.
I think it was.
I can never tell because sometimes I use our actors and sometimes their actors are sound like us, and we're like neighbors really, so it doesn't matter, and I don't know. It's definitely not a foreign language movie, and this is an interesting movie. This is a movie where the concept and the acting go hand in hand together in a way to that way you don't need any big spectacle or a lot of money or a lot of big production action sequences or anything like that to show off something where something really bad and global is happening, or at least global in their world. like something really astronomical is happening. It's in a way a zombie film, some zombie horror movie.
Sure.
But it takes like the zombie out, and it takes the gory aspects of zombie lore out, and adds a psychological twist to it. And the zombiness isn't really something you see in the film, or you see very rarely. And whatever you think the zombies really look like or act, they don't in this film, because the way it's portrayed is through keywords. People get infected through sound waves that when you utter a specific set phrase or words, and sometimes they evolve themselves into different words, become the virus that everyone's played with. And of course, this starts at a radio station, at a local radio, AM/FM radio station. I forget which one it was, AM or FM. And it starts with that DJ guy. And has a very, very interesting opening, and the way it sets up the concept, it can be a little confusing if you're not paying attention, but I think that the movie does a good job to keep your attention going, even throughout the more lull parts of the film. And it introduces this great concept that I really don't want to spoil too much, because I want everyone to watch it. And furthermore, if you had not seen it and are interested to see it now, if you stay tuned through after the credits, there's a great after credits sequence that even says more about the world that they're in. And as ridiculous as some of the stuff that sounds in what you see in the movie, it really makes sense. And that scene where he's talking her back out of the virus by saying nonsense words, and the way he says it, I think is one of the better scenes of the year for me, of Discoveries, as far as that goes. So that's all I'll say on Pontypool, but it's really cool. Pontypool is the name of the town, by the way. It opens up with the meaning of Pontypool. It's a really weird intro.
It is a really weird intro.
Anyway. So that's my number 8, Pontypool. Available on Netflix, by the way. So that's where I saw it.
Right.
So, Roth, what's your number 7?
My number 7 is a board game. I want to say it came out in 2015, so it does fit the criteria. The board game is called Codenames. In Codenames, two teams compete to see who can make contact with all of their agents first. Spymasters give one-word clues that can point to multiple words on the board. Excuse me. Their teammates try to guess words of the right color while avoiding those that belong to the opposing team. And everybody wants to avoid the assassin. This is a really cool game that it's a party game. And you can make it with as big a party as you want, or as small as 4 players. Because I think 4 players is the minimum amount you can play with. But that's why I say party game. It's a really cool game. I got it earlier in the year, or halfway through the year, should I say. And I just felt like I needed to bring it out during certain events like Christmas and stuff like that. That actually kind of worked out. You play the game, and I hope you liked it. It's really cool. You have to use these one word, like I said, like if you're the spy master, because you know who all your guys are. You use one word, and you're not supposed to emphasize anything. You're supposed to just say one word, and that word is supposed to help give a clue to whatever's on the board for your fellow teammates to guess. And along with that word, you give them a number. So if it's like, I say Pontypool, for example, and I say 2, maybe there's out there on the board horror and movie or horror and film, and hopefully they get
Canada.
Or Canada, right?
And DJ.
That's what I was trying to say. Like, and then you can't make your word too vague or too literal, because you never know. Like, too literal means you're just narrowing it, and you're probably only going to get one, and you want to get the first person to win. To get all your guys' first, so you want to maximize your one word effort. It's a really cool game, and it's really fun. It's really fast. You could make it really fast pace. Once you get the hang of it, I think people just kind of like run through things, and I really enjoyed it. So it's available everywhere. You can buy this at Target. So it's like everywhere.
That's good. It opened up to a bigger. It's not just like a boutique board game anymore.
Right.
What's it called again?
The name is called Codenames.
Codenames. Got it. I thought it was Secret Agents for a second. No. No, it's really fun. I played this like several times with you, Buff. It's fun as fuck. And anyone can play it.
Right. Anyway.
It's like a minute to explain. That's it. Once you know, anyway. So that's your number 7. My number 7 is a book. Here's another book here. It is a strange book because it took me this long to read it. It's called The Road.
Okay.
By Cormac McCarthy. Have you seen the movie, Ralph?
No, I never saw the movie.
But you know about this movie.
I know about the movie. I was going to ask if it's based on the movie.
Yeah, it is. Oh, the other way around.
Sure.
It is another post-apocalyptic thing, so clearly that's my shtick right now. And it came out in 2006. The Road, it is a post-apocalyptic tale of a journey of a father and his young son over a period of several months. across a landscape blasted by an unspecified cataclysm that has destroyed most of civilization and, in the intervening years, almost all life on Earth. And so, yeah, this is a small book, by the way. It's not that large at all. It doesn't hold up a lot of time as far as your reading material. What it does hold up is a fuck ton of emotional gut punches. And I remember seeing the movie in 2007 or 8, I don't remember what year it came out. And I really liked it. It stars Viggo Mortensen. I did really like it. I don't remember a single frame of that movie except for one of the cannibals in the movie and one of the flashbacks. I don't remember much about that movie. I clearly have to rewatch it. I'm faced to say, though, that I don't remember much about it. So when I read the book, it was kind of fresh to me again. That's how much I forgot. And the movie is emotional as fuck, Ralph. You have no idea the amount of, how well Cormac McCarthy is able to put you into the shoes of the father, who is always the voice of, in the one person perspective.
Okay.
So he is the God voice for all you know. And the way he thinks things through, the way he has to explain to his son, who is like, you know, crying all the time and not understanding all the death around him and the isolation. And, I mean, he does understand, but he doesn't understand.
How old's the kid?
Like 6 or 7.
Oh, shit, yeah.
Young as fuck. Most at 9, I think. I don't remember being that old. Definitely not a teenager. And there's some flashbacks introduced in the film. He gets it through, like, memories that he just can't help but see about his wife and how his wife had given up, you know, the years previous after having their child, giving up in this post-apocalyptic world and shoots herself or kills herself in some weird way. I remember how exactly, but I remember she was talking about the bullets and, like, make sure you get another bullet because bullets are really hard to find in this world now. And one for you and one for your son, because she won't do it and she just wants out of this world. And she can't believe that he is willing to try so hard to live in a world that is trying so hard to kill you. And the whole thing is a gigantic metaphor for all that and what it means to be alive and what it means to keep yours alive and your family alive. And it's heartbreaking, Ralph. It's heartbreaking. There's a scene where he's, like, sick and his son has... It's just so fucking sad. I guess we did, but I don't, but I don't know. Yeah, super fucking sad, hard-hitting-ass book. It has a crazy sad ending. But not, like, terrible either.
Sure.
So I don't want to spoil too much, but if you've seen the movie, you know what I'm talking about. Actually, I don't even know if the movie is that faithful to the book.
Really?
But if you read the book, you know what I'm talking about, because I really don't remember the movie anymore. I have to rewatch that movie. So that's The Road. It totally surprised me. One of the last things I read up on before the end of the year. I had my list set already, and then I read The Road in December, and, like, yes, okay, fine, you win. So that's my number 7, Raphael 2, number 6.
Because 1954 was such a good year to me. I decided to watch another movie, and that movie is called On the Waterfront. This movie is directed by Elia Kazan, who did other great movies, Streetcar Named Desire, East of Eden, just to name a couple. That being said, this is starring Marlon Brando, and this is a Marlon Brando that most of us would never probably... I mean, it's a picture that everyone knows of Marlon Brando, but if you've never seen anything with Marlon Brando when he was young, watching him in this is actually really, really quite stunning. I'll read the quick description because it's super short. An ex-prize fighter turned longshoreman struggles to stand up to his corrupt union bosses. It's an interesting movie, It's a little high on my list for how great of a movie it is,
right?
And especially how revered this movie is. I think we obviously know that Marlon Brando probably does a stellar performance, or he does a stellar performance. Not probably.
And I think who's the
there's Carl Malden.
Who's the Marlon Brando of today?
Who's the Marlon Brando of today? It's a good question. I'm not too sure.
Daniel Day-Lewis?
Jack Nicholson. No, I'm just messing with you. I was going to say not Jack Nicholson. What's that guy?
Would it be Daniel Day-Lewis?
Daniel Day-Lewis, yeah, probably.
I'm not the same roles, clearly.
Sure,
one's
sure.
Charming, one's scary
John
as fuck.
Travolta.
No. Sorry.
Nicolas Cage.
Yes.
I like Nicolas Cage a lot.
He
just does bad movies.
That's why he's on Marlon Brando.
Yeah, I know. I'm just naming actors to name actors.
I guess you are. Anyway, continue, sorry.
Regardless, this is a typical... I mean, these stories are really, like... they're so used, I hate to say it, but you're watching this in the 50s and they're not really that used. Like, you know, right. It makes sense for its time. So it feels very cliched, but at the same time, it's not, because it's its own, right? Where I'm just taking a really big glimpse in the past. You got some really, really powerful performances here. He's a schlup. He was a fighter. He wasn't even a prize fighter. He never won anything. He was and the only reason he was really chummy with the underworld boss was because his brother worked for the underworld boss, mm-hmm. and he happens to witness a murder of a beloved friend that he didn't stand up to help out, and because the boss told him not to. And, you know, he made him, obviously, he compensated for him, right? Like, hey, thanks for not saying anything. I'm going to, you know, hook you up or whatever. But he's a schlup, and he realizes that if he wants to ever do something in his life or have meaning in his life, he needs to stand up for it, and he shouldn't have his friends pushed around, especially since he was a guy who he thought he stood up for the little man. And for him not to stand up for a little man like there, a friend of his, an ex-prize fighter, somebody who could have done something, possibly fought his way into it or fought his way out of it or something like that. He takes a stand where he finally goes against this boss and speaks up in a time where nobody speaks up. I mean, there's a great scene where they go to the church in the basement of the church, and they're like, anybody said anything, like, you guys can confess to us, like, we won't say anything to anybody, you know, but we will eventually, like, lead to, like, you know, we need to stop this guy, right? And that gets broken up right after the, like, they don't go into the church because that's holy ground. But right after the church, they're all right there ready to catch and nab everybody and beat the fuck out of them because they're snitches. You don't rat on people, and especially longshoremen.
Right. You know, it's funny because I've seen, so I was moving to high school.
Okay.
So it's been a while, but I remember that scene the most.
Yeah, and it's a great scene because it's a really powerful scene because it teaches you, and it's something that you grow up with, kind of. And it's interesting that, at least I grew up with this, you don't rat on your friends, and you don't rat on the person that helps somebody, right? And unfortunately, this guy kind of does help out, you don't rat on somebody like that. He's somebody you know, he's somebody who, you know, he could get back at you, right, anyway.
Do you think this movie is worthy, the test of time that it's been able to
And that's what that's understand. An interesting thing, and I think it is, because it does it so well. And it does it well enough where, what's it called? You find that Marlon Brando, like, he kind of pulls the story for you. Oh my God, there's this other actor. He's super famous. He's in Miller's Crossing, and I can't.
John Turturro. Oh, you mean Albert Finney? Is it Albert Finney? I think so.
No, Cobb.
Oh, great, Dead Air.
So. Rod Steiger, I think. Maybe I'm wrong.
Steiger?
Yeah.
He's not in Miller's Crossing. Who is he in Miller's Crossing?
No. I forget. Okay. Maybe I'm just mixing people up.
Okay, maybe.
But I think the ending of this movie where it shows that where he kind of like he wins the fight. He fights for it, but he wins. Where he actually fights them and he shows how bad this guy is for the actual community, and what he's been doing for against everybody. And that you can kind of make up your own stuff from just willing to do hard work through it, and we should be able to help out each other. It's a really cool movie. It fights corruption, and it shows you that you need to fight corruption. You can't wait for somebody to help fight it for you. You need to fight it yourself. And that's a really big.
A gigantic theme for 2016. Also, with exactly. Political climates and shit.
Right. Yeah. Don't wait for somebody to help. Don't wait for even though there's somebody willing to help you. Don't wait for that person to do everything for you, because if you are willing, if you can fix it, you should be able to put in your two cents and go in and fix it.
Right. Do your part.
Exactly.
Right on. What year did that come out again?
54.
Oh. So that's your number six, right? We're on to my number six. This is not a cheat per se, but this number six is strange. It's a name of a person, and I'm talking about the works that she's done. The name is Andrea Arnold, and she has, I don't know about written, but I think written and directed several films, including last year's hit, American Honey. But I'm not going to talk about that movie because I already saw it in 2016 appropriately. But I saw her last three movies before that, last year in different times. Her 2006 Red Road, 2009's Fish Tank, and 2011's Wuthering Heights. And very interesting stuff she is. I think, and maybe some general plot description of these movies. Red Road, Jackie works as a CCTV operator. Each day she watches over a small part of the world, protecting the people living their lives under her gaze. One day a man appears on her monitor, a man she thought she would never see again, and that she never wanted to see. Now she has no choice but to, and compelled to confront him. And she has a lot of movies that had the same feel as that. Fish Tank is the film that put Michael Fassbender on the map. After this movie, Michael Fassbender, who I think most people saw him there for the first time, came out into international stardom after that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it was like, if you want to see where he started from. That plot for that movie is, everything changes for 15-year-old Mia when her mom brings home a new boyfriend. And yes, it is very similar to Diary of a Teenage Girl on that point, but it's not like that at all. Actually, there's only one scene devoted to that. That movie is very much into the headspace of a teenager, and a teenager growing up in a very specific environment that clearly Andrea Arnold, as we learned with her most recent American Honey, she really researches for. I think her thing is to show the moment of the now of her characters very well. And I think the fact that she uses a lot of like startup actors or no-name actors or barely actors to portray her, you know, her wonderful little, you know, personal pieces, I think works really well for her. And she's interesting. She's very, very much her own kind of person in her directing style and her writing style that I think Andrea Arnold kind of deserves her own little spot. She definitely carved out her own corner, so to speak, as far as directors go. And Wuthering Heights is probably her most contentious film, I think. I like the movie a lot, and I would say that some scenes I really loved. And even though her movies are like the epitome of movies I'll never watch again, because they are not really rewatchable, except for maybe American Honey, I think I won't forget any of them anytime soon, is my point. And Wuthering Heights is based off that book, and it's been remade like 1,000,000,000,000 times. But I think of all the Wuthering Heights adaptations I've seen, which is like 3, it is probably her best, for sure. So that's Andrea Arnold, the works of Andrea Arnold, so to speak, the director. So yeah, that's my number 6.
That's interesting. Nice
yeah.
Pick.
Yeah, it's very strange. And yeah. So we're going to take a quick break real quick. When we come back, we'll do our 5-2-1s. So, stay with us.
Wow, I'd like to be as smart as a computer.
Actually, we already have a computer.
Great news! Now, before we begin our journey, I just need to get some information from you. What's your name? Where do you live? What do you like to eat?
I live in my house!
Spaghetti!
Well, my name is...
Great news! Now just a few more questions, and we'll be on our way!
Wait a second.
What's your favourite colour?
Stop talking.
Do you like cows or goat's milk?
Be quiet.
Do you have brown hair? What is your blood type? Are you allergic
to... Shut up!
Don't touch me!
What?
All right, we're back. Hopefully I picked a good clip. Good job, Oscar. Anyway, let's go on to our number 5, Rob. What is your number 5 discovery in 2016?
Shouldn't have been good job, Oscar? Like, question mark?
I have faith in future Oscar to pick a good clip. Yes.
Okay, interesting. My number 5 is a band or music duo. They call themselves The Midnight. They are a synthetic or synthwave duo comprised producer and songwriter Tim McEwen and singer-songwriter Tyler Lyle. So yeah, this is all like, I guess, synth music with saxophones. It's interesting. I am bringing that in. They got 2 albums out. One came out in 2014. And the other one came out this year, or this past year, 2016. And I actually really enjoy their music. It's really cool to just kind of like have in the background and just kind of listen to it. It's just like kind of focuses you. It's they're an LA band, or LA duo. And I really liked their their 2 albums. One's called Days of Thunder, and then the other one's called Endless Summer. And it's just, it's a really cool, really cool music to listen to kind of just like get you in the zone, get you focused, but relax you at the same time. To whatever you kind of want for it, it can work for both ways. And I really enjoy it. It's this weird synth wave type of music that normally I'm not into. But I don't know, they do a good job of keeping me intrigued, at least this new album. That's why I call it my cheat one this year, because I've discovered them. They've been out for a while, right? But their latest album did come out in 2016.
Oh, okay.
That's my cheat. But at the same time, like I said, their older music is still good also, so I'm not complaining about it too much.
Okay.
But yeah, it's a really cool album. You should totally listen to. And it's just like if you want some cool saxophones or like kind of video game music, it's like this retro thing going on. It's really cool. I really enjoyed it. That's The Midnight. You should.
The Midnight.
Yeah. Hmm. They're on Spotify. Yeah, it's The Midnight, not The Midnights. There's a bunch of artists called everything else. So like, right. If you need to look for them, look through Endless Summer sometimes also. That works.
And Endless Summer is one of their album name?
That's their latest album, yeah.
Gotcha. Got it. That's cool. Yeah, I know nothing, so I can't really relate to anything on that. I can't piggyback on that. But my number five, real quick, is the trilogy of documentary films that that came out a long time ago, written and directed by Penelope Spheris. And it's the Decline of Western Civilizations, Part 1, 2, and 3. The first one, let me read a synopsis for each real quick, because they do explain a lot. The Los Angeles punk music scene in circa 1980 is the focus of this film, with Alice Bag Band, Black Flag, Catholic Discipline, Circle Jerks, Fear, Germs, and X. That's the first one, and it kind of goes into the punk scene very vividly, really cool. Let me read the second one here. Why is it so difficult to suddenly get it? And it's funny. So that one came in 81. In 88, she did part two, a documentary that showcases what life was like for the music artists living during the Los Angeles heavy metal scene in the mid and late 1980s.
Cool.
And the last one, which is probably the most contentious, and it's clearly like if you want to consider them the Godfather, part three is definitely the worst kind of thing. You know, that's how a lot of people see it. And I see it the same way. Just in a different way. And it came out in 1998, so skip a decade there.
Oh.
And part three is a 1998 documentary that follows a gutter punk lifestyle of homeless teenagers. So you can see how it goes downhill, I guess, but not only in the form of the subjects that she's interviewing rather than the music itself. And it's very interesting how people see the latest in music wave as the worst, because we see stuff that came out a long time ago as better days gone by, which I think that's why people don't like the part three as much. But part three is much more like just sad, just really sad. It's super sad and a little bit of gross too, but not gross like the movie is bad for it. It's just that these people that she's interviewing are just like have really terrible lives and they don't want to shape up, you know. Anyway, so these films are documentaries. They're all different, and even though they're all different, they have the stamp of the filmmaker at the same time. The first one, the punk one, it's captured very much like concert footage, bar, not really concert. They're really just bars, really, and of the punk music scene, right? That sprung up seemingly out of nowhere, and the impact of the youth in America of that time, I think, is captured so well. It feels like you're there in 1970-something when she's filming it, /1981 or whatever. You feel very much like you're living present day that time. And the beauty of that capturing is amazing. You don't have to be a punk fanatic to understand and love the film. Now, I happen to love punk, so I do both. I remember Luke really did not like that movie because he's more of a heavy metal guy, which goes through part two, and which he liked a lot more. I would say that part two is a lot more scripted. It's a lot more like a lot of ego on the screen, because of the way that some of these artists, including like Ozzy Osbourne, for example,
sure,
and others that I'm just forgetting the names because I saw this way early in the year. I think I saw it in July of last year, all three in a row. The heavy metal one is like you could tell like all these artists were either wished to be or at least agreed to be shot and lit in very much like high punk standards, like with women around them or in their kitchens or in a jacuzzi bath or, you know what I'm saying? And it kind of talks about the...
Living the life.
And also a lot of them talk about like, it's not about the music. It's about the money that they're making. It's about the fame that they're getting. It's not the glamour of their costumes reflect what they want out of this music stuff. Unlike the punks who are doing it for just the music, even if they live like rats in a cage, which is totally different. And part three is a gigantic... misstep, not misstep, but like misstep for generations, I guess, maybe, because the gutter punk scene is exactly what it sounds like. Punks live even worse squalor than the ones from the 70s, because at least they brought the movement in, and the punk gutters from the 90s are shown to be indifferent. No one cares about them. They're indifferent themselves. And it's a gigantic, you know, downer of a part three.
I can imagine.
So I can see why people like it the least, but I still find all three films very fascinating. And they're very, very good documentaries. I'm surprised it took me this long to watch it. I've only heard about this trilogy a couple of years ago, so it's like a big hole in my movie history thing. It's definitely required viewing for a lot of people who are into or are trying to be cinephiles. I recommend it for that.
Okay.
So as the decline of the Western civilizations, part 1, 2, and 3. We're on to our number 4, Rob. What's your number 4?
My number 4 is a movie that came out in the 50s. Not 54, though.
Man, you saw a lot of classics, huh?
Yeah.
You were catching up, my son.
I was on the Turner Classic Movie Channel.
Clearly.
They had some good runs, like in 2 months. I saw a lot of movies. This is a 1957 movie called The Bridge on the River Kwai.
Oh, yes. That's a good one.
I'll read the quick synopsis.
Another one I wish I saw last year.
After settling his differences with Japanese POW camp commander, a British colonel cooperates... oversee his men's construction of a railway bridge for their captors, while oblivious to a plan by the Allies to destroy it. This movie, directed by David Lean, starring William Holden, Alec Guinness, Jack Hawkins, and Sesu Hayakawa. My apologies. It's an interesting movie, man. You see these British soldiers get captured, they're POWs, and they're put to work because that's what you do. We're just not going to just feed them or whatever. You know, get something out of your POWs, right? And they go on to, you have to go do this thing, right? They have to build this bridge, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
But they're supposed to do this under harsh conditions because the Japanese don't want to abide by the Geneva Conventions. And that's a really cool intro. Where this colonel, the Colonel Hawkins, I believe we said, or William Holden, should I say, Colonel Shears, he really pulls, like, he wants to go in and, like, no, like, you need to abide, like, where the officers get treated nice, right? Because this is the Geneva Conventions.
Right.
And the officers basically get to lead our men, get to do what we need to do as officers still. And then, you know, we'll help you lead whatever you need us to do to our men and lead our men because we're supposed to do it. And he does it with an iron resolve, and then he does it with an iron fist because he's already beloved by his crew, by his platoon.
Right.
And it's a great little intro showing how much he is beloved and how willing he is to abide by the rules. But so much so that it kind of turns into this crazy thing where this crazy passion project for him to build this bridge to help, theoretically, the Axis, which it is helping because it's moving product around for them through trains. What's it called? To help them by building this bridge, they're helping move products. So technically, you're helping the enemy out by working for them. Mm-hmm. But they take great pride. He takes amazing pride in this, to where the point where he fucking names the bridge, and he has like amazing things for the bridge. He puts up all the best effort for it.
Yep.
And it's a crazy, crazy thing where he ends up taking over the project from the Japanese. It's such an amazing thing. And then you have the other side, where the Allies are like, hey, they're building this bridge that's going to help them send forces or send more troops and everything else.
Right. So it's like a small team.
Right. We have to destroy
an ex-prisoner to try to sabotage the bridge.
Exactly. And I think the end of this movie, it does a great job of showing like coming to the realization, this the colonel, that, oh shit, I should let this happen because I'm actually an ally, not an Axis.
Right.
And I let this go too far. And he's been all of his lieutenants and everybody else has been telling him, like, hey, man, like, why are you taking this so seriously?
Dude, that's a startup idea. Put a fault in it.
Right, exactly. Right. Like, dude, like, we're helping the enemy. He's like, yes, we are, but damn it, we're going to be the best prisoners of war. And they fucking
were. But also, like, I like his viewpoint because it's very old school dad, like, because that's like your dad.
Super old school.
And whatever you're doing, if you're going to do something, do it right. He has, like, that mentality of it. It's strange.
It really is. Man. And it speaks a lot to his character. But it speaks a lot to his character and his character flaws as well. So that's why I really love this movie. And it was such an eye-opener. It was done brilliantly. Watching this in high definition, remastered, does this justice, man. It's such a great movie. It's a long movie, but it's such a great movie. And it's a movie that definitely fits in. Like, everybody, you need to watch this movie.
Very cool. So that's The Bridge in the River Kwai. Classic film. Your third or fourth classic already, Ralph?
Believe so.
We're on to my number four here, and it is one of my few classic films, oddly enough. It is Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And let me read the description. A bitter, aging couple with the help of alcohol, not much of a help there, use a young couple to fuel anguish and emotional pain towards each other. And it is a film directed by Mike Nichols. I think it's his first film, and it's based on Ernest Lehman's script. Starring Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, George Segal, and Sandy Dennis, or Denis, possibly. Seth, Nick, Honey, George, and of course, Martha. It's also came out in 1966. This is a very contentious film. It's a black and white film in an age where Technicolor did exist already, and it was much more of a... Like, you think, you know, a lot of people, you know, like, oh, man, a black and white movie? Like, back then, since color was a more generation, first-gen thing, the fact that they actively did it in black and white must have been a huge step back for a lot of people. But regardless, I think the black and white serves very well to force you to focus on the actors and the action and nothing about the setting. Because the setting, even though it is meticulous in the way they walk and they react to it, these two couples are just in rooms talking. That's the entire movie.
Right.
But what they say, what comes out of that saying and talking,
yeah.
It is as big as Michael Bay's biggest explosion, as craziest as M. Night Shyamalan's twist for me. It is the epitome of really good storytelling through drunken buffoonery, you know, And it almost has like an Inception like quality because you don't know where the game began and
this is a good
where reality
this is a
ends.
Good night gone wrong fast,
really fast,
right? But you don't know for who, and you don't know if for who is the other couple,
right?
But you don't know if it's for these guys also or not. Like, you don't know where this game ends.
Right?
It's a crazy game.
Yeah. When did you? I'm curious because you saw it last year too. When did you find out that it was a game? Was it right away?
No. I think I found out it was a game when they took that quick intermission where they separated.
Yeah.
And then they go and they talk to the couple separately and they kind of tell you how much they hate each other.
Right. Yep. The same way.
That's,
me too.
That's what it happened.
Me too. When she takes it to the bathroom. Honey, like, hits herself or something.
Right. And he's on the swings about his children or something weird.
Yeah, they had like a child, but they're not supposed to talk about it. Right. They have a different name for him or her.
Yeah, and that's actually where the game kind of, it does manifest.
And it dovetails too after that. Yeah, very interesting movie. Very, very cool. Very earnest and really well acted. Particularly by the older couple. Man, they're so good. Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. Of course, Elizabeth Taylor is really good. And it stars a very young George Segal, which is interesting from, you've seen his face, right? That guy.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's a really interesting movie. Watch it. I don't know how you guys can see it. I think we rented it back then. But it's available. It's an old movie. It's available at least to buy or rent somewhere. So that's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And it is my number four. We're on to our number threes now. Ralph, what is that?
Because I have a trend going. My number three is a book. And this book came out in 2014. And is a continuation. It is a... Stephen King book.
Oh, really?
The book is called Dr. Sleep.
Oh, right. Nice.
Yes. So Dr. Sleep is a continuation of The Shining, where it follows a now middle-aged Dan Torrance and the very special 12-year-old girl he must save from a tribe of murderous paranormals. This takes a turn for, like, he really embraces The Shining and what world there is in this. And I really enjoy it for this. I'll read this whole description just because it's a good description. On a highway across America, a tribe of people called the Trunot travel in search of sustenance. They look harmless, mostly old, lots of polyester, and married to their RVs. But as Dan Torrance knows, and spunky 12-year-old Abra Stone learns, the Trunot are quasi-immortal, living off steam that children with the Shining produce when they are slowly tortured to death. Haunted by the inhabitants of the Overlook Hotel, where he spent one horrific childhood year, Dan has been drifting for decades, desperate to shed his father's legacy of despair, alcoholism, and violence. Finally, he settles in New Hampshire, in a New Hampshire town, and a community that sustains him, and a job of nursing home where his remnant shining power provides a crucial final comfort to the dying, aided by prescient cat. He becomes Dr. Sleeps. It's an interesting thing. It's a long beginning because they had to set up so many things, and you kind of don't know where it's going, and it's kind of
soul vampires, dude.
It's kind of dull also. There's a lot of stuff going on, but they do a lot of time skips because he kind of goes through his ages of like 20s, 30s, and 40s. So like,
yeah, they go with the chef Dick Halloran dying,
exactly,
right, and being his mentor, his mother eventually dying, and him becoming old and getting over alcoholism, which is what his father had.
Exactly, yeah. And he realizes why his father went into alcoholism, and like, well, the reason he did it is to kind of get away from the horrors of his past. And where he gets to when he finds this little girl named Abra, and it's just super interesting how he. How strong this little girl is, and how he goes against these paranormal, the Trunot. And that whole, like, thing that happens after that, or, like, that whole, like, interaction, when they find out that these people exist, and they find out because, like, it's such a weird thing, but how he goes about it is very clinical, very kind of methodical, and, he has a lot of faith, and it's a lot of like faith going into it of what his abilities can do because he's been there, and it's a lot of like you have to trust it, and we as the audience trust it because we've seen the movie, we've read the book, so we understand it. But he's trying to explain that to a little girl who's just living through this. Like, she's a teenage girl and very understanding.
Teen or preteen? I forget.
I think she was like. Preteen. She's preteen. Right? Preteen, yeah.
12, 13.
Preteen, yeah. 12, 13. She's about to be a teenager. Yeah. So, yeah. And it's such an interesting story, man. Like, it's really cool. It's really well written. Stephen King writes really well.
Really good horror scenes.
Right, and exactly.
I like how they indoctrinate that newest member, the snake one.
Right, yeah. Where she's she uses just to get by.
Right, her movie theater scene. I remember that very vividly, even though obviously it's a book. But, yeah.
Right, and that's what I was about to say. As I mentioned earlier, a really good book pulls you into their story, and you get to what's called project the image of what's being told to you, or what you're reading. That's what a really good book does, and it should do to you. And this book does it amazingly. I can see myself everywhere. Yep. And it's not just the description of it, because you could read something description-wise and just be like, well, it's because I read the description of it. You're like, no. It's like how the story's being played out. You can see the action scenes in your head, and it's how it's playing out. It's really cool, and it's really done really well. And I really love this soul-sucking vampire thing that is going on. And you feel for...
The Black Hat Woman.
Right, exactly. You feel for like that one big death with that one kid. Like, you really feel for the characters that they're introduced. Even a low-key character that's just there to push plot. That's how he's found, because she finds out that one of her own is being killed, and she happens to be looking through one of the eyes of one of the killers.
That's right. That was really cool, man.
Such a cool scene.
Oh my god, the tension part. Scene when she's projecting, doing that mission with Danny Torrance, but she's at her place, and then she has to trick the vampires that are on her way to her house to find her. Oh, that was so cool. That was like a very nail-biting scene. Like, oh my god, get the fuck out of the house.
It really is. There's a lot of callbacks from the beginning. And like I said, the beginning of this book has to do so much, I think, plot build-up for the other second half of the book. But it does it in spades. And I really love the ending, especially where his alcoholism, he had this one horror story that you really believe is a horror story. And then when he finally says it at the end...
Oh, the woman that he left?
Right. When he says it at the end, everyone's just looking at him like, yeah, man, it's just a story. Okay, buddy. And we thought, like, you killed, like, 10 people or something. Yeah. And, like, it is a horror story, but it's not as bad as you thought it should have been. And I think Stephen King does a great job of explaining how bad it was for Torrance's.
Well, how bad a personal tragedy feels to the person?
Sure, exactly.
Even if it's not compared to the world,
and it's felt really strong. So it's portrayed really well. So that's Dr. Sleep.
I'm with you. I wish I read it last year too, so I can say it this year.
Yeah, I have a lot of that. Would have made it.
Yeah, we have a lot of that going on. I also been catching up to this year and last year too. Last Stephen King. None of them made this list this year, but some made my short list for sure. So that's your number three, right? My number three is a web series.
Ooh.
6-episode run series, and I showed you a little bit of this. It's
That's right.
The Don't Hug Me, I Am Scared. Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared. Not I Am Scared. It is. It's funny. I'm here at the Wikipedia page, and the genre of it is puppetry, horror comedy, and animation. And it's created by Becky Sloan and Joseph Pelling. It is from the UK. It is 6 episodes long, 1 release per year, because it is a very indie thing. They had it's really high production value, and each episode's like 8 minutes or so. But like the fact that they did one a year, that was the best they could do. And the last one ended this 2016 in June. And it's let me read the description as best as I can here. This is by a really good description. Each episode starts like a typical children's series, consisted of anthropomorphic puppets akin to Sesame Street, but eventually takes a surreal plot twist in the climax, usually set with psychedelic, disturbing content involving graphic violence and jump scares. However, at the same time, the series parodies children's shows by ironically juxtaposing puppetry and musical songs against mature content. The six episodes explore the subjects of creativity, time, love, technology, diets, and dreaming. And it is a very contentious show. It is probably the thing I most rewatched and discovered in 2016. And kudos to my girlfriend, Alexis, who showed me this thing for the first time.
Cool.
Never heard of it. She kept quoting it to me, like, what the fuck are you quoting? And she showed it to me, and I haven't stopped watching this damn show. And I've gotten other people hooked on it, too, as you can imagine. And it's super interesting. It totally is a complete breakdown and very to our culture, and it becomes, therefore, counterculture to, like, some of the stuff that's going on with a lot of TV and how TV networks are run and how art is seen through the way that the fact that these people had to make the series and how it would literally, clearly make no money and make no investors, you know, jonesing to give them money because of the fact that what they're showing is a breakdown of how media is portrayed.
Yeah.
And even if you take that apart, which is more subtext, and you just look at the puppetry stuff, breaks down the idea of children's stories and Sesame Street and those kind of Teletubbies and stuff like that, and how their information are seemingly very arbitrary and contradicting compared to what it should actually be like. And it shows a fallacy of all that stuff in every episode, and how it explores specifically time and the diets one, the healthy food one. If you watch the healthy food episode, it is very jarring. It is very, very like nightmarish, but I think it does a good job to show you how ineffectual we are at providing the mass of the public with knowledge, reality, accurate knowledge on how foods work, for example.
Right.
And dietary and stuff like that, and it's all processed foods out there. We're clearly living backwards here.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting. And just even if you follow the characters alone, they'll have a general plot through, and you can go online and see breakdowns of this entire show. Every single scene in this, every single shot and action of these puppets, animated or not, It's so meticulous, Ralph. It is like Edgar Wright movie. You know, it's a very meticulous, very choreographed specifically for your enjoyment and, you know, repetition of it, too. Every time you watch, I watch it, I always catch something new, which is very interesting.
That's interesting. Okay. How long are the movies?
Each episode, 6 episodes long. Every episode is like 8 minutes. Not even, you know. So, yeah. And the music is kind of addicting, honestly. I won't lie to you. I kind of find myself humming it every once in a while. Which is, I don't know if it's like, if they're like incepting me or not. I don't know.
Probably.
So that's Don't Hug Me, I'm Scared. It is a boutique charming show that got a lot of critical views over its 6-year run. So that's on YouTube and on Vimeo. That's my number 3. We're on to our number 2. It's a home stretch. Ralph, what's your number 2?
My number 2 is a comic book that I happened to stumble across because it was on sale. Yay.
Yay, sales.
It is a Valiant comic called Divinity.
Oh, this almost made my list, my short list.
So the creators are Matt Kint and Trevor Harrison. And I'm going to read this cool description from Valiant Comics itself because it's a little long, but I'm going to read it regardless. Okay.
Yep.
At the height of the Cold War, the Soviet Union determined to win the space race at any cost. Greenlit a dangerously advanced mission. They sent a man further into the cosmos than anyone has gone before or seen. Lost in space, he encounters something unknown, something that changed him through... Sorry, I'm reading this in a weird text. Something that changed him, long thought, and erased him from history, the history books. The few that have been able to reach him believe him to be a deity, one who turned the scorch deserts into the harsh oasis. It's an interesting. So what happens is like this. Man, this is crazy. So the Russians, because they're the Russians, they did this amazing thing where they wanted to go the furthest into space, a man, right? And they knew it was a mission they were never going to come back from. They just wanted to say, this is how far we got, this is how far we can get, right? And these guys encounter alien life somewhere else. And he ends up kind of becoming a god where he kind of masters time and relativity and a bunch of other stuff like that. And that's he becomes this divinity thing, right?
He becomes Dr. Manhattan.
Basically, he gets back home, and he kind of like uses his past. Obviously, we as humans want to fucking immediately either take him out or just kind of control him, because that's what we humans do.
Right.
And you see this cool thing where he's just like, "Hey, I just want to live on my own, but I want to live where I lived on Earth." And I want to live my own thing, and I want to help people. But at the same time, I don't want to be bothered. And it's this weird thing where they end up like tricking him to live in his own mind, where they don't really trick him because he just wanted to live in his own mind regardless.
Right.
And it's this crazy, crazy story about how troubled this one guy was and how he wanted to portray it to the rest of the world and fix it, but... He ends up coming to this big realization of, no, like, that's not my job to do, even though I have these abilities, these amazing abilities that I could change the world how to my liking. He doesn't. He chooses not to. And he chooses to live in his own world and kind of, like, suffer through his pain that he went through, right?
Right.
It's really cool. And it leads to this next Divinity series that started in this past year, 2016, but I'm talking about the original, because it was a crew. It wasn't just him who went. And we realize that the crew is the rest of them also. But it's such a cool series, and I love how it's drawn, and I love the dialogue in it also. I just think these two guys did a great job of making this kind of come out in a comic book form. It's a really interesting story or narrative, and our idea also of how crazy the Russians would do this for Mother Russia, and I do believe that they totally would do this. Like it doesn't fall off. Or at least from what we think they would do.
From
that.
What we think.
Exactly. What did you think of Divinity?
I love it. And I'm not caught up at all to the second run or second season or whatever, volume. But it's such a good concept. It's such a great, like, it's oddly grounded in some part of real history. But it takes that kernel into a nice sci-fi, like, exploratory setting. of, like, not adventure per se, but, like, what is the limits of science fiction into one man, and it's really cool.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah.
So that's called, Divinity, right?
Just Divinity. Yep.
Cool. You know who, company who made it?
Valiant.
Valiant. Gotcha. Thank you. So check it out, guys, on your local comic book store. That's your number two. My number two also is very comic book related and heavy. My really big comic book related thing. It's a person, though. It is the works of Brian K. Vaughan, which I had not read his stuff or known his stuff until really this last year, where I'm gonna read. There's three series that I've been reading of his for the first time, and I haven't finished any of them. I'm caught up to the most recent one, but I haven't finished so his three works. I'm gonna just say real quick: it's Saga, which is very very huge. We Stand on Guard, Paper Girls. Those are the and Why the Last Man. So it's four. But I think We Stand on Guard is like a very short run. It was like one and done. Paper Girls is very new. And I think season two ended this last year. And fantastic comic book series. Saga supposedly is still ongoing. But either way, I'm like halfway through what has been out there so far. And Why the Last Man is definitely an ended comic book series. And that one, I'm on like volume four right now. And he has I had been reading Paper Girls and Why the Last Man before I realized that it's the same guy. Oh, the same guy's connected anyway, because I know there are other writers and illustrators at the same time. They are different. But he's the one guy, he's reading all this stuff. And then it came across, We Stand on Guard. I'm like, did this guy do this too? I'm like, goddamn. Right. So I went out and searched for his other stuff, and sure enough, they're all pretty great. Like, Saga is a sci-fi, like, fantasy series that sprawls many planets, very similar to Star Wars, except he makes his own version of everything, and there's no force or anything. That's his own thing, but it's it creates a world where, like, you know, from planetary and racist setting of between two different worlds of species fighting and warring with each other. The way that they look, the design of these people/beings are very fascinating. The way the assassins work in that thing, and the way a crossbreeding works. Very fascinating stuff in Saga. And then Why the Last Man has a concept of some disease happens in the world, and every Y chromosome male in the whole planet gets killed, except for one person, the last man. And him and his male monkey are the only surviving male anything in a world full of women. And what kind of world do we see if that were to happen? And what and you can imagine there are people trying to, like, see if they can safely get him across the country to a lab, in this case, to see if they can do some tests and find a cure. But also, like, in that process of that journey, there's a lot of love and loss, love and death, you know, like new life happening. And there's this whole bit with the astronauts that then doesn't working out really well. And yeah, it goes all over the place, but it's really good. And it's fucked up, man. The Amazons and this gang, that kind of national gang that comes out called the Amazons. And they hunt down everybody who is still, like, wishing that men were back, you know? The ones that miss men, and they're, like, anti-men, and because of the way that they control the world and shit like that. It's really interesting stuff. Really, like, political, socio-commentary stuff. And then, Paper Girls, which I think is the one you know, Ralph, right? That's the one you read?
No, I haven't read any of them.
You haven't read those either?
No.
Oh, fuck. I gave them to you.
No, you didn't.
I will tonight. Anyway, Paper Girls is very interesting. It's a 80s-esque sci-fi story about the, you know, newspaper girls from the 80s who, you know, one morning they're doing the paper run and they encounter basically aliens from a different time zone, a different time dimension of some sort, which they speak an alien language and shit like that, but they look humanoid, but they don't know if they're humans. And sure enough, they get involved into some technology. They get transported to 2016, where one of them meets an older version of them, and they're like, and it's very complicated, as you can imagine. They're like, I've only gone this far, you know? So it's both very loving and very adoring and charming, but also very serious and very cool sci-fi going on there. So I recommend that as well, Paper Girls. So yeah, that's Brian K. Vaughan, the works of him. He is the head writer for most all of these. Some of them he's the only one. Others he helped conceptualize with other people. But he is the main through line of all these projects. So yeah, Brian K. Vaughan, happy reading his shit. He's really fucking good. I really like his stuff. Really great for sci-fi and fantasy. That's my number two. What is Pray tell, our number one's Rob. What's your number one? Are you ready?
Yeah. For the most part, my number one is a episodic series, video game series, called From Telltale.
Really?
Yeah, it is Tales of the Borderlands.
Oh wow, really?
Because I never played any of them at all, any episode at all. I had achieved the Telltale fatigue, you know, where I did it and what I just felt like, ugh. And now they're doing Borderlands. Like, what are they doing in this world that I could possibly like? And they did everything in the world that I possibly loved. And it's introducing these characters, making them heroes and heroines in their own light. And what's it called? Going through this narrative and going through this story that I really loved in Borderlands, where, you know, but these guys are metahumans technically, and these guys are just regular Joes who are just trying to, like, achieve some status. And it's interesting. I really enjoyed all five episodes, and I was trying to pace myself because by the time I got it, all five episodes were already gone. So yeah. I would finish one, and I'd be like, give yourself some time. And I gave myself like a week, and then I would download the new one. And then by the third episode, I was just like, I'm just going to finish it all. And it was really, it's a really cool narrative. It's by Gearbox Software's, or by Telltale Games, but the Borderlands franchise comes from Gearbox. And it fits kind of perfectly into this world. And it shows you a little bit more of Borderlands that the other series doesn't want to show you.
Which, because I never played it, but yeah, I played this, never Borderlands.
Right, go figure. Like, the first two Borderlands are really cool, but then the third one, or the prequel, was meh at best. And this one is just kind of like, I don't know, it's a great in between. Great in between, but after. Shows a lot of characters from the other Borderlands. But, I just really love the story. It was a great narrative and great learning, showing kind of, you're just still pick your own adventure, but at least choose your own dialogue and choose like what kind of like relationships you're going to have with these people. And, it's really cool. You try to play what you think is right, which is what's really cool about the game, is that you think you fall in line with a lot of people's decisions that you make. But at the same time, you're like, oh, wow. Like, other people just didn't pick those decisions at all.
Yep.
And that's what's really cool about the game. Overall, it doesn't take away anything from the actual narrative too much, besides the fact that you may miss out on characters, you may, you know, not, and stuff like that, or how the ending's going to happen. But other than that, like, the story still finishes, and that's what's really cool about the story, about the game. And I really liked it. It was a really good game, and it played awesome. And I just fell in love with the story. That's what kind of pulled me through this. And I had to put a game in there. So in my top 10.
That's so funny because I think it was Luke's number one when we made our top game show last year.
Yeah, I think so.
For 2015. And I didn't make my number one, but I made not top 10 for sure, my number five, I think it was.
Sure.
So I'm glad that it came out again somewhere. I'm glad you see the wisdom into the really great comedy and Tales from the Borderlands.
Right, exactly.
I agree, man. I almost want to replay it. I don't have to, obviously, because I feel like it's a one-time trick pony.
Right.
But it's like, I almost feel like redoing it just because it's so charming and funny and good. All right, so went to my number one. Not as charming or as funny or as any of that. It is a documentary called The Arbor, which I know that very few people have heard about. I really am not surprised. This is from the UK, somewhere there in England. It is directed by Cleo Bernard, and it is about the portrayal of the late Bradford playwright Andrea Dunbar. Andrea Dunbar did a play called also The Arbor, and did others as well. She is, this is a very complicated documentary to explain, because it is a documentary that uses actors to, what do you call them? There's a term for it. It's slipping my mind right now. It's the term where reenactments of not her plays only necessarily, but also her life and how that happened. And oddly enough, Andre Arnold's life is much heavily in, completely is dominating her playwrights, her plays that she wrote eventually. And she, I think, committed suicide in the 90s, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And The Arbor, I mean, put it this way, when I saw The Arbor, I did not know what I was going into. I saw it on movie. It just came up out of nowhere. I thought it had a fascinating premise. And I saw it, and not knowing anything about the playwright. I'm just not familiar with plays, guys. I'm not very good with that world. So I knew nothing about the power of this girl. And she came up with a very bad home, and all her writings reflect that not only her home, but almost to a personal, detailed level, what happened to her own history and life, except that maybe she'll change a fact here or there or a name here or there, but it's really her life. And the way she introduces it in context of the medium of plays and how she was becoming a big playwright in her own right back then, and then she still fell into alcoholism and drugs and constant children out of wedlock. Like, that woman did not live normal and lived really bad and tortured life. And The Arbor, the movie, clearly has a very nice, keen touch to the writer herself. And so in order to best, how best to tell the story of a playwright that wrote about herself constantly is to create the play that she was best known for creating it over her life. So she creates The Arbor, which is what the movie is based on.
Okay.
And it's very, like, fourth wall breaking. It has a really great actresses playing for the family members that are part of her life that are really playing roles from the original play. Very interesting. Done, like,
right.
Like, what is it? Meta thing.
Sure.
Meta layers. And it's so rewarding watching this film, and it's so heartbreaking. It is the road of movies for me, if you want to call it that. But in a much more satisfying way because of the delicate nature of someone that really did exist. Because The Road is all fiction. The fact that is one of the few times where a documentary, the power of a documentary, is more served than a fiction narrative film. So yeah, I really love it. It's one of the best documentaries I have ever seen. Period.
Wow.
It's The Arbor, my number one.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I recommend it. It's hard to find it, though. I'd have to buy it.
Well, it's a movie, right? So, yeah.
It's an old movie. Not old, super old. It came out in the 2000s, but it's such a limited run. It's not available anywhere.
Okay. Wow. You kind of, like, rent it or anywhere?
I've never seen it. I saw it on a movie. Like I said, they have strange movies all the time there. So that's that's their point. So, I don't know. I do want to get it. I'm waiting for a good release, but I just don't think it'll ever happen. So I might have to bite down and buy the shitty DVD release they have.
Yeah, that sucks.
Anyway, but that's it. That's what our number. Those are our top 10 discoveries in 2016. Do you have any honorable mentions for this kind of list, Swef?
I do. Give me 1 second.
Yeah.
Let's see. Zootopia. No, I'm just messing with you. I have this artist called Sufjan Stevens. Have you heard of Sufjan Stevens?
No.
It's super indie, super. I can't even explain what kind of music he does. There's this one title specifically called.
Oh, it's a hymn? It's kind of like a her, anyway.
Called Chicago. That it's an amazing song. I'm talking about amazing, and I really love that song. And I love some of his other work too. I just like he's really like he's kind of out there also. And I just I really liked his music though. It was such a crazy song, but I loved it so much. I can't even tell you what kind of thing it is. I listened to this other podcast that I got end of the year. It's called Pardon My Take. It's a sports podcast. It's a sports satire podcast. So what these guys do, and it's really funny. These guys, they talk about the stuff that's going on currently in sports, right?
Right.
The games that just happen and everything. But they make fun of everything by like being really serious, but at the same time they're
like
not
dry humor?
Super dry humor.
Like sarcasm?
Sarcasm up the fucking wazoo.
Okay.
And they'll even talk to guests, like famous people, coaches, and other things like that. They'll introduce them to the podcast. They'll interview them, and they'll be like, how does it feel for this? Like, and they'll ask, like, the stupidest questions. And they're just having fun. But they take it like they're like the most serious thing. Like, they wanted to make their own bowl for the... you know how they have, like, the Rose Bowl and the... Not the Super Bowl, technically.
No, I don't know about...
For football. But this is for college football, and they wanted to make their own, like, without making their own. They kind of just wanted to take over. They're like, this game's coming up. We're going to call it this bowl, and we're just going to, like, it's brought to you by us. Like, and it's just so stupid. Yeah. It's a really cool show. It was really funny. And then I wanted to mention the 30 for 30, because 30 for 30 seasons, not all of them, because some of them just recently happened this last year. But, yeah, those are amazing documentaries, TV series things because they're made for TV. But yeah, those are just amazing things to watch.
I'm purposely saving the 30 for 30 for this year, so maybe it'll make my discoveries next year because I started late in the game of the year. Right. So I decided to wait on discs. I'm going to start watching those fuckers now. My honorable mention, some of them here. I wrote a lot. There was a lot I watched because I wrote down everything, like I said. I try anyway. Like, I just remembered a podcast that I did not write down. It wouldn't have made my top 10 anyway, but I'll mention it real quick. It's a zombie horror tale of survival.
Nice.
It's called, I think it's just called like Zombie or something. I forgot. Anyway, doesn't matter. Anyway, it's pretty good. And they have too many ads, though. Anyway, so here's, I saw Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench, which is, Damien Chazelle's first musical. I saw that.
How was it?
It's good. I think the ending is really fantastic. I think he's really good with the endings. The ending song is the best song, clue.
He starts with the ending. He's like, let's make everything else.
Right, yeah. I think that's what he does because this is three times in a row now where the ending
makes it. Really? Three times? What's the other one?
Well, Whiplash.
Whiplash, that's right.
I mean, that ending is insane.
That is a great
ending. It's crazy good. But, I mean, I think it's the best movie, probably. Anyway, the musical aspirations of Carol Emerald, who has a really great voice and a lot for jazzy downbeats and whatever you want to call them. I'm not good with musical terms, but I basically blind bought two of her albums, and I like almost every song too, so that's cool. There is In the Heat of the Night. That was my first year watching it last year. We reviewed that for our previous podcast. The biography of Jesus Christ, the movie called the book called Zealot.
Yes, that's right. I almost read that book.
It's a good book. It's short too. It's not too long. A lot of information. And it does the best job it could possibly do considering where we're at in history, right? But obviously it's not super accurate because we don't know. Vader, the comic book Vader, I know that you gave me all of them. I'm almost done with it, and it's definitely extensive. It's my number 11, basically. It almost made it.
Yeah.
That's how close it was. I almost would play something on the fly while we were talking, like, should I put Vader on here? That's how good that is. I saw a lot of, I read a lot of... Stephen King. I read Cell. I read 11/22/63, which is way better than the show.
I bet.
But still not good enough for the top 10, unfortunately. Divinity, we mentioned. The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which is a Western with the classic, man. What's his name?
I know who you're talking about, but I know.
Yeah, anyway, just watch it, people. Murdered Soul Suspect. It's that game.
Yep.
One of the very few games that even made up the shortlist. A Chinese action movie called Let the Bullets Fly, which is very, very interesting and long, and a lot of money spent on that movie. And real quick, the last one here I'm going to mention is Lady Snowblood, which is the basically the film that Quentin Tarantino most took or was inspired from to do Kill Bill.
Ooh.
And if you watch that movie, he just ripped scenes completely from that movie. Lady Snowblood. I recommend it highly. It is a Japanese old classic, basically B-movie slasher, and it's really, really good. The first one. The second one, I tried watching. I didn't care for it. But the first one's really good. So, yeah, those are our top 10 discoveries of 2016. That is it for our show, finally. You can send feedback always to anything we talked about and maybe suggestions for your own for discoveries at podmoviecast@gmail.com. Please send us a rating. Give us a rating on anything that you're listening to us from, either Podcaster or iTunes or whatnot, Stitcher, right? It does amazing wonders for us as a fledgling new podcast, especially since we're starting from the ground up. I mean, we're not critic writers or we're not celebrities, so we're really starting from scratch here. So any little bit helps, really, truly. So, Ruff, this is our last top 10. I think we're going to take an extra week off. We are normally bi-weekly. We're going to come back in 3 weeks because it'll actually even out with my SOS fucking schedule, too. I don't want to do two podcasts a week if I can avoid it.
Right.
It's already hard enough to do all this. So, yeah, we're going to come back in 3 weeks and we're going to start reviewing films. We haven't nailed down what we're going to review. I think one of them for sure will be The Founder, which is out currently in theaters right now, which is starring Michael Keaton. About the founder of McDonald's. We hear that the movie's amazing. Luke can see it. It's in his theaters in Colorado.
He saw it already, yeah.
Yeah, I think he saw it. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm going to see it. And so the other two are patent pending still. We're going to figure that out. We're also going to have Oscar talk. We know that the nominations are out. They're out as of this recording already. They've been out for a few days. We are definitely have a lot to talk about, some gripes and some, you know, celebrations too, because some of that stuff we're like, yeah, that's totally cool, that Moonlight got nominated, for example, and La La Land and stuff. So we're going to talk about that stuff as well in our regular show format when we come back, and after that it'll be bi-weekly like normal. And we hope you've enjoyed the show and enjoyed our end-of-year stuff. I know that the Oscars are technically the real end of the year, but for us anyway, it is the end of year. This is the last show for that. So, for Twitter, you can always follow me at Armin Filmmaker. That's Filmmaker with A-R-M-E-N. Ralph?
You can follow me at Gamer Ralph. That's with two R's and an F.
Sweet. Stay tuned. We'll come back in 3 weeks. Happy hunting. Bye-bye.
You will not remember the last hour and a half of what you have just seen. You will forget the contents of this movie.